Thank you, Suzanne. We're just going to alter the program a bit, and it's a great pleasure to vous présenter Monsieur Brian Haynes, qui est associé au cabinet Bennett Jones à Calgary, et aussi un membre du conseil du gouverneur de McGill et un membre de nos conseils d'administration à l'Institut. Welcome, Brian.
Thank you, Suzanne and Suzanne. Good morning, everyone. My name is Brian Haynes, and I'm delighted to be here today in my capacity as a member of the Board of Trustees of the McGill Institute for the Study of Canada. I now have the pleasure of introducing our second keynote speaker, Philip Moeller, who is a two-term commissioner of the U.S. Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, also known as FERC, serving under Presidents Bush and Obama. First nominated to FERC by President George W. Bush in 2006, Mr. Moeller was nominated by President Barack Obama for a second term in 2010. FERC is an independent agency that regulates the interstate transmission of electricity, natural gas, and oil. FERC also reviews proposals to build liquefied natural gas terminals and interstate gas pipelines, as well as licensing hydropower projects. In the current context, it is worth noting that what does not fall under the jurisdiction of FERC is oversight for the construction of oil pipelines. From 1997 through 2000, Mr. Moeller served as an energy policy advisor to U.S. Senator Slade Gorton, where he worked on electricity policy, electric system reliability, hydropower, energy efficiency, nuclear waste, energy and water appropriations, and other energy legislation. Prior to that, he served as a staff coordinator for the Washington State Senate Committee on Energy, Utilities, and Telecommunications, where he was responsible for a wide range of policy areas that included energy, telecommunications, conservation, water, and nuclear waste. Prior to that, Mr. Moeller worked in the energy industry for a power developer and an integrated utility. Commissioner Moeller joins us now for his keynote address on the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission's role in regulating oil pipelines and liquefied natural gas. A brief question and answer period will follow the keynote address. Please join me in welcoming Commissioner Moeller to Montreal and McGill University.
Merci, bonjour, thank you for having me. It's great to be at this beautiful university in this beautiful city. Great to be back. I grew up in the state of Washington, not too far from the border, probably about 100 miles. And so my family and I would visit British Columbia and Alberta quite often. My older sister and my father came here to Expo 67, which has been a lasting impression, at least for my sister. And I try and make sure that we keep our connections, particularly with my colleagues at the provincial regulatory level and also with the National Energy Board, relatively tight. We try and keep that dialogue going because we have so much in common and we're truly, as nations, joined at the hip. Again, the National Energy Board is somewhat similar to what we have as a role in our jurisdiction at the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. It is different somewhat, and the nature of particularly the electricity system is different in the United States than it is in Canada. But nevertheless, we are still kind of quasi-judicial regulators, somewhat of a policy role, somewhat of a judicial role in our regulatory duties. My thoughts today will be focused on what we actually are responsible for at FERC in an attempt to better inform you if you're interested in our role in these emerging issues, and then also talk about some developing issues and take any questions that you care to offer. One of the things is that as an independent regulatory body, we're independent commissioners, and I think that's a very good model. It means, though, that I only speak for myself. I don't speak for the United States government or for the president. I don't even speak for our commission. But that means you're welcome to disagree with me and sound off in any way you want, and I won't take it personally. In fact, usually when I get to Canada, I get some of the more penetrating questions. Perhaps people in the United States are somewhat intimidated by our role. So I welcome a discussion and a dialogue. The role of the Commission is largely an economic regulator. Most of our time, honestly, is spent with the electric wholesale marketplace, along with the reliability requirements that we have for the bulk power system. In that case, it's extremely relevant in both baskets, but particularly on the reliability side with how we deal with the provinces, since we are an interconnected system. In Canada, largely north to south with the United States, as opposed to east to west in terms of the electric transmission grid. As Brian noted, we're also regulators of the hydroelectric industry. If a dam produces power and it's not owned by the federal government, we are the safety regulator on an ongoing basis. We have about 2,500 power-producing dams in the United States, and we're also the regulator that will grant a license to build one, or more often, a re-license after a term of usually 30 to 50 years to keep the project going. As I mentioned, most of our work is in the electric wholesale area, but we're also regulators in the oil and gas industry. And I'll focus first on the oil side. The FERC has its foundations in terms of legislation from 1920 when we were formed really just to focus on hydroelectric facilities. In the 1930s, the Federal Power Commission, as it was known, took on the responsibility of regulating the electric market at the wholesale level, and then later on through the Natural Gas Act, the natural gas industry. In the 1970s, we became the FERC from formerly the Federal Power Commission, and absorbed parts of the Interstate Commerce Act, which gave us jurisdiction over the shipment of oil in pipelines. So as Brian noted, we don't site oil pipelines, particularly, obviously, Keystone is in the news. The siting of oil pipelines is done by the states. However, we would be the economic regulator of any oil that flowed through the pipeline, and we are an economic regulator of the extensive pipeline system in the United States, specifically on oil and gas. I'll get to gas in a moment. So because it's a monopoly service for the most part, a couple exceptions to that where we've seen that there might be the potential of market-based rates as opposed to regulated rates. The energy or the oil bar comes in and has a contested proceeding on the rates to ship oil. And we have those cases in front of us, always have. They have increased in their numbers lately. The oil division of FERC was typically about 12 people, and it's expanded, and they're a lot busier now, given the dynamics of what's happening with oil production, particularly in the United States, up in the Bakken area, and the fact that we're seeing now a significant development of converting some natural gas pipelines to shipping oil because of obviously the new market dynamics related to it. So with oil, we're in the game, but in terms of kind of the hot political issues of whether new pipelines are being proposed, particularly if they cross the border, we are going to be on the secondary level of regulation related to the shipment. Natural gas is much different. We have a much more significant role in natural gas. We are the siting agency if someone proposes to build a pipeline that crosses state lines. If it's solely within a state, we do not regulate it. But if it crosses state lines, a developer would come to the FERC for what we call a certificates of public convenience and necessity. And that analysis is largely environmental. There's somewhat of an economic analysis that goes on when we grant or deny a certificate. But for the most part, that's the part where we are safety regulators in terms of actually having the ability to grant the pipeline, the ability to site the project. Then we become the economic regulator as, again, a monopoly service. The shipment of the gas on the pipeline is always in a contested rate proceeding that comes before us when we put on our judicial hats to determine the rates. We also have a role in energy in gas storage, a somewhat limited role. but we will again grant certificates for underground, largely storage. And it seemed within, well, probably a couple of years ago, that I was voting on a multi-billion cubic feet expansion of a gas facility almost every week. Now, those have slowed down significantly in the last few months, but we've had a great expansion of underground storage, which from an economics perspective is good. The bigger we have the gas tank, the more we can moderate price spikes. And, of course, that depends on the geology of the region, whether they can actually have underground storage. And it is spotty throughout the country, a lot of it in the Gulf area, occasionally some in the west, some in the northeast. Those areas that have it benefit from it. The areas that don't have it wish they did, but there's not much they can do about it. So gas has been a very big set of issues that has developed, particularly over the last few years. I have been on the commission now for 7 years, and I like to bring out the example of 5 years ago, the most controversial energy projects that I was voting on were LNG import facilities. And arguably the most controversial projects that I vote on now, 5 years later, are LNG export facilities. You can't get a more extreme 180-degree turnaround than that. And you all know the reason. It's because of the development of hydrofracking along with horizontal drilling that it's opened up an enormous amount of resources in this country. I sat on our National Petroleum Council study for a couple of years. It was released about 2 years ago that projected oil and gas resources in North America out to 2030 and 2050. It's still a pretty good read. The executive summary, about 60 pages. The full document is several hundred. You probably want to skip that one unless you're really into this stuff. But a couple of takeaways of the 2 years that I spent with this study. Number one, North America has an enormous amount of gas that we didn't think was accessible even a few years ago. And that's obviously changed the dynamics. That's one of the reasons we're here today. The second takeaway is that technology will only allow us to find more and extract more. Now, as a society, we may choose to restrict access to some of those resources, either through restrictions on the type of drilling techniques that are used or putting certain areas off limits. I'm not advocating for that. I want to make that clear, but as a society, we can make those decisions. But the fact is, we have an enormous amount of gas throughout the continent, and technology will only allow us to find more. Pretty fundamental basic assumptions, I think, moving forward in this discussion. As I noted, LNG facilities now have been, in some cases, converted or proposed to be converted to export from import facilities in just 5 or 6 years. You know, the enormity of that policy shift is stunning because that's a really short amount of time in the energy industry, 5 years to have a complete turnaround. And we're in the middle of it, and the dynamics are just plain fascinating. The politics around LNG export facilities are kind of have really, I'd say, three significant players in the government realm. Of course, the developers first come to us to get, again, one of these certificates of public convenience and necessity that allows them to construct a facility. That is largely an environmental review, although, again, there is some economic analysis that goes into our decision on whether to grant a certificate or not. But the more interesting side of the debate, it really sits with the Department of Energy. I'll also note that our Department of Transportation has a role within our process. The PHMSA group at the Department of Transportation does the dispersion studies, and they're the ones that, until they come up with a dispersion study, we are unable to grant a certificate. But the real debate, the hot debate, is at our Department of Energy, because they are the ones that determine whether a facility is granted the ability to export gas to non-free trade agreement countries. And that's kind of the golden ticket that a developer wants. And so we have a number of facilities that have been proposed. We've approved a couple of them. But what they really, really want is that approval from the Department of Energy related to exports, non-FTA countries. That's where the big market is. That's where the hot political debate is. And I'm happy to not be a part of that decision because it is very controversial. If you've been following it at all, you know that we have entities that want to export a lot of LNG. We have particularly the industrial sector that would like to put some limitations on that, keep the gas in North America, frankly, keep the price lower so that they can use it in industrial applications, and that debate is ongoing. The department is methodically going through the analysis of each of those projects, and they, for the most part, are not trying to rush through it. In one sense, that's my perspective from watching what they're doing. But there's always a little bit of a talk of whether there's going to be some kind of a soft or a hard cap limiting the number of BCF per day that can be exported. And some people have thrown out a 6 to 8 BCF number. Again, there's nothing in the law that would mandate that, but at least that's been a bit of the talk of the town in terms of going forward. So the issues going forward for us are really case by case as we look at the applications for LNG facilities. We're seeing the dynamics of the pipeline system shift. Not only are we seeing some conversions from gas to oil, but we're also seeing the flows change. I mean, we used to be very dependent on gas coming from the Gulf of Mexico. And now we're seeing, because of the developments, particularly in the Marcellus area, gas from an economics perspective, frankly, from a regulator's perspective, it's really good that that gas is showing up there because it's kind of in the middle of the demand area. And yet we still have enormous problems. We have a lack of pipeline capacity into the Northeast. Traditionally, the Northeast has been the end of the line. At the same time, the Northeast is basically phasing out all of their old fossil. Coal and oil are being shut down in a dramatically short amount of time. Even nuclear has been shut down in the Northeast. And the Northeast market, the electricity market, is becoming increasingly dependent on gas to fire generation. Now, here's the problem. Pipelines have been traditionally built on long-term contracts that have been signed by the local distribution company that provides natural gas. Again, they need gas. They need their gas when they need their gas, and they can't have any exceptions so that people's pilot lights don't go out. So they have financed pipelines largely on long-term contracts. The new customer base for gas is power plants. But because the Northeast is in a day-two market, most power plants are committed only on a day-ahead basis. And some days they'll be committed, some they won't. So they don't have the same incentive to pay the higher rates for firm access. Hence, we're not getting pipelines built in the Northeast, and we need them desperately. I mean, here in the Northeast, roughly less than 100 miles from the Marcellus Shale, and yet it's a real conundrum, a real challenge to get the right financing model to get that additional pipe built. I mean, we saw prices going up to $350 for gas in the last few weeks. It was a short time in limited areas, but by far the highest price gas in the United States, by far, is in the Northeast because of the demand for direct use and also for power generation. And it's frustrating that we can't come up with some kind of a model to get more pipelines built, largely for a reliability perspective. And then there's economic benefits as well. That points to a larger trend that we're seeing in the United States, which is that natural gas has clearly won the battle for new power supply on the electric side. I mean, we're shutting down an enormous amount of coal megawatts in the Midwest, but also in the East. That's being often replaced by natural gas as a power source. We're seeing much more renewable power being generated in the United States, wind and solar, but because it is intermittent in nature, that has to be firmed up, usually with fast-responding gas plants, which, again, are a draw on the natural gas side. We're seeing conversions from coal plants to natural gas, so that's, again, creating more demand on the gas side. We're seeing the fact that it is very difficult to build electric transmission in our country because there is no federal siting authority. So oftentimes, utilities, instead of building transmission, which would be a more economically efficient way to address power shortages, because it is so difficult to do that, instead they'll site a gas plant there instead because it's easier and it's quicker. And then, of course, the price aspect of it with the shale revolution has led to gas clearly winning the battle. And yet the gas industry is fundamentally very different than the electric industry. The speed of the fuel moves at 20 miles an hour through a pipe as opposed to instantaneously with electricity. The infrastructure is financed in different ways, as I've alluded to. The people who are in the industry have usually grown up either on the gas side or the electric side. There often aren't that many who have been in both industries, and they actually speak different languages. Sometimes the same word means different things on the electric side and on the gas side. And so we're seeing a big challenge as these two industries converge, making sure that we do what we can to, frankly, to keep the lights on and the power on. And we've had a major undertaking at the FERC to try and address this problem, first to make sure that these entities can communicate with each other when there's usually a supply crunch, most likely the winter, but it's happened in the summer as well. I think we've gotten over that hurdle with a rule that we enacted in November. The next set of challenges that we have is that the electric day and the gas day trade at different times. The day starts and ends at a different time, creating some inefficiencies throughout the markets, where particularly in New York, they'll complain that with the gas day starting at 9 in the morning or 10 in the morning Eastern time, it's the absolute worst time because a generator will get their allocation of gas on a 24-hour basis. And in New York, they're ramping up electricity production in the morning as people get up and go to work. And that's often when people have used up their 24-hour allocation of gas before 6 a.m., which is when they need it the most. So we have a set of issues that we have to address in terms of aligning the trading days on electricity and natural gas, certainly not without controversy. And the third area is the one I alluded to earlier, the conundrum about how we can finance new pipelines that are clearly needed, but under kind of a new business model, because it's not the local distribution companies on long-term contracts that will back up the financing of those pipes. It's a new set of customers. It's power plants that, again, are not likely to sign up for firm capacity. So hence, how do we break this conundrum of getting pipes financed? So it's a set of issues that certainly is relevant given our interconnectedness, not only with pipelines, but also particularly on the electric system, north to south, the provinces taking power from the United States, giving power to the United States, often depending on the season and the demands. An interconnected grid is good. We have to keep our communication levels up and keep talking through these issues. Again, I'm sorry I'm not a little more of a controversial oil and gas person, but nevertheless, you can ask me controversial things if you wish, and I appreciate your attention, and again, for inviting me to this beautiful place and hopefully encouraging a dialogue.
Thank you very much, Commissioner Moeller, for your very interesting address. We will now turn to a brief question and answer period. And in order to capitalize on Mr. Moeller's limited time here today and allow for as many questions as possible, I ask that questions be framed as such, that they be brief and to the point, and that you state your name. So we do have a few people lined up at the podium, but let's start with you, sir.
I'm a retired long-distance farmer who spent his career here in industrial pharmaceutical research. I follow the Guardian Weekly quite regularly, and several months ago they had a pretty data-presented comparison of gas and oil as well as electricity. It was entitled Cold-Blooded Profiteering. I'm not sure if it included North America, but it was focused on Europe as as I recall. I hadn't looked at it for a long time. Just a quick comment on protests. The pharmaceutical industry was beset by much of this, and I remember when I started it.
Can you state your question, please?
Well, that's the question, then. Okay.
Okay. Did you understand the question? I didn't either. So could you just state your question briefly?
Well, I want to know if the conclusion of the Guardian Weekly about cold-blooded profiteering by gas and oil and hydroelectric companies is justified, because that was the title of their presentation along with a lot of data. In other words, what they're saying, this was about 6 months ago, that the companies are, the retailers or the providers of these products are cold-blooded profiteers.
Well, we're economic regulators, and our challenge is to balance the fact that we want to protect consumers but send the right kind of investment signals to get the infrastructure built. It's a trade-off, and every case is different, and we want to make sure that there's enough energy for consumers to get it at a price that's fair. So that just and reasonable rates is the standard that that we're based on in our federal statute.
Thank you. If I can ask a question myself, is the transportation of oil by rail and the safety thereof an issue FERC is investigating?
Well, we wouldn't have a direct role in it. Obviously, it's a very timely topic given what's happened, the tragedy in Quebec. We've had some accidents in the United States as well. And there's been, just in the last couple of weeks, the announcement that our regulators will be, we're looking at this very closely with some proposed new standards related to safety. That's not in our jurisdiction. I think how it affects us is that the argument would be that it's safer to transport oil by pipe, and I think the safety numbers back that up. I realize some people probably don't want to hear that, but I think the data is pretty, I just saw something a couple days ago where they analyzed accidents per billion barrels of oil, I believe, rail, truck, pipe. Pipe was by far the safest. So I think it will impact us to the extent that we may have more conversions of gas to oil in pipelines. We'll probably see more pipelines proposed. I mean, we're seeing that now. Just huge expansion in the last 5 years. But again, we're only going to be the economic regulator of that, not the safety regulator.
Right, okay. Quick question.
Hello, Felix von Geyer. I'm a sustainable development journalist. I'll get inside the box here. The U.S. emissions, I think, increased about 2% last year because there's actually a fuel switching back from gas to coal because of the increase in gas prices. Mm-hmm. I'm just wondering, how much does that disincentivize infrastructure investments in the gas pipelines you're talking about, but also what's the need to invest in smart grids so that you can actually kind of get a more equilibrated energy trading between sort of electricity output and the feedstock that's required? How much of an impact could that make?
Well, let me answer the second question first. It's easy for me to talk about the smart grid because I don't have much jurisdiction over it, but I'm a huge proponent of the smart grid because I believe in consumers having choices. And I think when they have choices, they make good decisions based on their priorities. Now, that is largely a retail decision. And again, I'm a wholesale regulator. So it's my colleagues at the state level, in some cases cities, who will make that decision. there are risks to the smart grid in terms of reliability, making sure that it can't be penetrated by hackers. We do have smart grid aspects on the wholesale side that related to the transmission system, but for the most part, we're talking residential or commercial use. And I think it's a great technology because right now people really have very little perspective about what they're consuming, how much it costs, and in many cases, the choice that they have, not so much here in Quebec because you have so much hydro, but some consumers are willing to pay more for green power or some other aspect, and in many cases, they don't have those choices. The smart grid helps enable that, in my opinion. The other disconnect that we have, a little less so here based on your model, but we have retail rates that are largely flat, and they don't reflect the real-time price in the wholesale level. And that sends some very mixed signals to consumers. And so you have a case where, you know, 200 hours a year, usually in the summer, where I'm from in the Pacific Northwest, it could be in the winter because we're winter peaking. But for the most of the United States, we're summer peaking with air conditioning load. Those 200 hours a year where power consumption is the highest, power is extremely expensive. And yet retail consumers don't see it. And the other thing is that in the middle of the night, electricity is very, very cheap. Sometimes it actually goes negative in pricing. And that's usually when the wind is blowing. So I would like to see our retail rates help reflect a more accurate wholesale signal, because then we'll get appropriate load shifting. We should do what we can to be consuming power at night and not during peak hours, because the more you consume power at peak hours, the more power plants you have to build, the more lines you have to build. And you can also argue that under the present system, poor people are subsidizing rich people during peak hours, because they're paying the same rate, but they're using disproportionately much less energy, and it's not being reflective in the true cost of the service. So, long way to say I like the smart grid, and I'm hoping we see more dynamic retail rates that better reflect the cost of producing the power. I think we'll be better off as a society. We'll pollute less. The earlier point about the 2% increase in emissions, we've had the dynamic over the last year of gas prices creeping up. I don't know what the actual average was nationwide all year, but somewhere in the $4 range, I'm guessing. That's the point where coal and gas, by some utilities, coal can potentially be cheaper. It's different if gas is at $3. What we've just seen in the last 6 weeks, with the very cold weather hitting a lot of the United States, obviously here too, is a realization that we're a lot tighter on the gas side than we thought. Prices reflected that. And now I just read something this morning about a gas shortage in California because the rest of the country is using so much. So I think we'll see clearly a higher price this year, which probably means coal becomes marginally more cost-effective, and then it'll depend somewhat on the infrastructure build-out to moderate those prices because, again, there's a lot of gas there.
Okay, very good question. We have 2 minutes left and two questioners, so if you can state your question very quickly and briefly and to the point in quick succession, and we'll let Dr. Moeller answer both.
Hi, my name is Lily Schwartzbaum. I'm involved in Climate Justice Montreal and Divest McGill, and especially in resistance to the development of the Line 9 and Energy East pipelines in Quebec and Ontario. So I noticed something interesting. You didn't mention climate change at all in your presentation about the National Energy Board. And actually today, the first mention of climate change came from the banner drop that happened this morning with resistance to tar sands, but no one has actually talked about it in this forum. So something interesting, I don't know how the FERC works, but the National Energy Board in Canada doesn't consider climate change.
Just take your question, please.
Yes, it can. So the National Energy Board decided not to include climate change in their consideration for the Line 9 pipeline. And I was wondering, does FERC consider climate change when it thinks about the safety of the people who are affected by the pipeline? And
just one question.
No, I think this is important. So you said that...
Is it more important than his question?
Well, I think we could do both. I think you said that...
Because we're going to run out of time.
You were really happy that your decision didn't relate to the development of energy. And I wanted to ask how... Because you said that you were... relieved that the regulation was not involved with the politics of what was happening and that it was controversial. I was wondering how you can make that kind of assumption that the development of a pipeline isn't related to the expansion of dirty oil.
Well, I think... If I implied that I was happy that I didn't make the decision, it was more that I do make the decisions on natural gas pipelines, and we have plenty of work to do, and it's somebody else's job under the law to site oil pipelines. So hopefully that's clear. Climate change. We do not specifically have a as part of our environmental analysis, have a climate change requirement or analysis when we look at infrastructure projects. Some have asked us to do that. We were taken to court, and the court said, no, it's not our responsibility. So obviously we listen to what the court says.
Okay, very quickly, please.
My name is David Plazek. I'm a political scientist at Johnson State College in Vermont. I have two questions about fracking. The first is, what can you tell us about the policy?
Pick one.
What can you tell us about the policy regarding the chemicals that are used in the process?
Okay. FERC doesn't regulate fracking. That's an environmental regulation that is largely done by the states with some EPA involvement that's, some would say, is growing. So my knowledge base would be just what I absorb, which is a growing trend of disclosure, sometimes required, sometimes voluntary. I know that there's an industry group that has formed to try and better inform people as to the specific mixtures that they use in terms of some want to protect that as proprietary, but you know, it kind of differs state by state, and again, there is an industry group that's formed to try and lead to more disclosure. My general sense is that the big developers recognize that there's a value in getting more of that information out so that they aren't constrained, and that some of the smaller developers probably see it as a burden. But that's just a general personal observation.
Okay, thank you. Unfortunately, we've run out of time, so this brings an end to the question period. On behalf of the McGill Institute for the Study of Canada, I wish to thank Commissioner Moeller for his time, sharing with us a fascinating insight into the work of FERC. It has truly been a pleasure. I thank you very much, and we have a token of appreciation. Let's say. The CD from Tim Huss, Western Star, who played for us yesterday, so hopefully you enjoy that.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, there's no break. We're gonna